My name is Michael Gaia, publisher of The Lead Lag Report. Joining me for the hour is Frank Capillary. Frank, congrats on the CNBC gig, but introduce yourself here to the audience and to me. Who are you? What's your background? What have you done throughout your career? And what are you doing currently?
Great. Thanks a lot, Michael. I really appreciate you having me on. Let me start by saying that I recently discovered all your music and I've become a big fan. You know, quality rock music, as you know, is extremely rare now. So really enjoying the Despite It All album. Keep it up.
I appreciate that.
No problem. Okay. So I'm the founder and president of CapThesis, which is an independent technical research firm based out of New York. So I provide market commentary and trading ideas to institutions, financial advisors, and private investors who have an interest or an active interest in the market. So I started CapThesis about a year and a half ago, September 2022, after spending 25 years on Wall Street. So for 22 of those years, I was at Instinet, which is the equity arm of Nomura, the big Japanese bank. And 16 of those years I spent as an equity sales trader, but always had a technical bent. And so I was always doing commentary. And as those years went on, I did more and more content creation. And so I made the decision to leave trading at that point to focus on content specifically. And so I spent some time on the research sales desk there, as well as becoming the desk strategist toward the end. And so really all that gave me exposure to all the major players really across the institutional investment landscape, right? Working side by side with other sales traders, with our sales force, with the research sales desk, with fundamental analysts on the sell side, and then spending all that time as a sales trader, talked to many buy side traders along the way, then more buy side analysts, and then of course portfolio managers. So they gave me a very good idea of the type of content, at least from a technical side, that really the players that drove, the financial markets really, found important. And so, I started CapThesis for two main reasons. One, to continue to serve my institutional client base in that way, just as a more independent provider, of course. But just as important, I wanted to provide, helpful content to people that typically don't have access to Wall Street Research. So as you know, there are plenty of online services out there now, newsletters as well. Some are very good, but many are not. I think people need more than, say, rapid-fire trade alerts. It has to be some well-thought-out reasoning and education behind any market call or just regular analysis. And that's what I aim to provide here at CapThesis: clear, concise commentary that helps convey, of course, what the financial markets are saying, with the end goal of really just having a deep and positive impact on clients' financial lives. And so that leads us to the 3 years when I got started. And I got started at Smith Barney in 1997. So people that are not as old as I am may not recognize the name Smith Barney now, but they're now Citigroup after a number of different mergers. So I got there again, 1997, very good job environment that year. And so I interviewed with the technical analysis group within Smith Barney. And that was run by, who I didn't know at the time, two technical analysis pioneers, Luigi Mata, who's still at it, who I talk to you all the time. She's wonderful and great analyst. And also Alan Shaw, who ironically just passed away a few days ago. And he was just larger than life. I actually just wrote a LinkedIn article about him, if anyone wants to check it out, how he impacted me and some of the experiences I had with him. And so the bottom line was, I didn't know too much about technical analysis going into that. Because again, 1997 may not feel like it, but the internet was just getting started back then, so it wasn't really a wealth of knowledge at your fingertips. But what I did realize was that I wanted to learn, and I wanted to learn as much about the markets in general. And in my mind, I said, I'd probably learn about a sector or two that I'd like, and then go into that from a fundamental basis. Well, you can probably understand how that went out. I just, was there in 1997 to 2000. Number one, thought overbought was the best thing possible from a technical analysis perspective, kind of like now, but we'll get into that in a second. And also just realizing that you can really learn a lot about what the market is saying by technical analysis. And that's how I, made the leap from there. And then ironically, when I got to Instinet, which was March 2000, literally 2 days before a market rolled over. And so that was a much different environment. But that's really the background up until we got to this point.
Apparently, you have a habit of starting new gigs at major turning points, right? September exactly. 2022, right? Which, was obviously right before the October low and that period in 2000. Okay, and it's funny, I will say, this is a small industry for those that have been in the industry for a while. You mentioned Luis Yamada, which a lot of what I would call the FinEx basement traders probably are not familiar with that name, but I'm very familiar with that name because she was one of the good friends of a gentleman named Steve Chauvin, who was relatively known in the 90s at Lehman Brothers as a technician, and they kind of ran in the same circles as Steve Chauvin and my father worked together. So, you know, I'm kind of familiar with that side of things. On the content research side, this is going to sound like a strange question, but I think it's interesting when you're in it. Do you find that providing research, providing content, that viewpoint, is it more fun in a secular bull market or more fun in a secular bear market?
You know, I guess a lot of people have one bias or the other. I find both of them interesting for a few reasons. Now, of course, market's going up, right? But it's one-sided to the most part. I know there's some divergences in there, but and I'll get into this as well, but so when you have a secular bull market, things tend to quiet down, so to speak. It gets, I wouldn't say boring, but there's not as many whipsaw. So for some people, that'll say there's not as many opportunities for that sense. Where 2022, you know, of course, was much different. And so the people who concentrated on mean reverting strategies in that sense did very well. For someone like me who looks for, at least, you know, I look for patterns on both sides of the tape, but bullish patterns in particular was very difficult, right? But at the same time, I think both provide challenges. And for the most part, Michael, as you know, having a down market for extended period of time, this doesn't happen a lot or has not happened a lot in the past 10 or 12 years. So I think that was interesting and challenging. And of course, coming into that, as you mentioned, you know, as I started Cap Thesis, it was trying to identify an actual term was actually the biggest challenge.
Okay. Now, you throw the term, the market, out there like a lot of people do. And obviously most people, when they hear the market, they're thinking the NASDAQ, the S&P 500. I've been pretty loud and consistent in my point that this is a very weird market in that a rising tide is not lifting old boats, certainly not in the same way. And we can debate whether that's something you typically see at the start of bull markets or the start of bear markets. But I want to get your thoughts on defining an uptrend in the context of market cap, because I shared that post earlier today. As much as, yes, it's true, the S&P and NASDAQ, new all-time highs, that looks like a bull market. By definition, it reset the drawdown, so it is a bull market in those indices. Most things beneath the surface are still way below their 2021 peak. So I question if it's really an uptrend or if it's just market cap-weighted momentum that's getting narrower and narrower, causing a bit of an illusion in what the actual trend is.
Yeah, now it's obviously a very important point. Well, when I talk about the market, of course, it's S&P 500 first, but I do think you get some good feedback from that. So in terms of those four traits, I'll just mention each one of them first, then we can go into each one in more detail. So number one, again, this is looking at the S&P 500. Every market needs successful bullish patterns, not just one, but continuous ones that feed upon each other. Number two, a low frequency of 1% daily moves overall, both up and down. But number three, you want more 1% gains than losses. Obvious, but I'll get into that. And then four, just from a very short-term point of view, frequent closes above the intraday midpoint. And so when I say successful bullish patterns, a few things come into that. Number one, you need to have a formation of one, right? And so I'm looking at either, you know, the classic ones you think about, inverse head and shoulders pattern, cup and handle, or anything else you want to throw out there like that. So for that to happen, right, you have to have something form. You have to have the market create some higher lows, higher highs, have a breakout. The most important thing is have that when that breakout happens, you can't have an instant retracement that takes out the breakout zone, right? And so then if all that occurs, then of course the next step is to hit an upside target. And so in the very simplest way to do that, again, going back to classic technicals, is just having a measure move target hit, right? Very simple, but that very thing did not happen at all in 2022, right? So if you're not surprising, but important to realize. And I think, you know, I look at that, this way of looking at things, because it helps eliminate some of the noise that you get when you're overbought or oversold, right? And so you had plenty of bear market rallies in 2022, but they were so sharp that it didn't really get a sense that, you know, regular bullish patterns could be formed, just because the markets were just moving so quickly that by the time something set up, it already ran its course, a 10-15% up and then reversed as well. So it was very difficult. And really, that environment, from my perspective, lasted until through the first quarter of 2023. It didn't really change from my perspective until really coming back from the regional bank crisis and having a breakout in April, and then looking at, you know, some of the stats, you know, in 2022, for instance, there were, getting into the next thing about 1% moves, there were almost 131% moves in 2022, just amount, an equal amount of 1% advances and declines. So you're basically talking about a year that had one of the greatest amount of 1% advances that was down almost 20%. And then you turn that now 2023, again, still had a fair amount of 1% moves in January, February, and March. Flip the coin, April through December, completely changed. And so a total of 66. So just about half the amount of 2022, and the market was up 20%. And so how does that tie into bullish patterns? Well, if you think about it, if you have a fewer amount of big moves, you're going to have fewer whipsaws as well. And so I like to look at this as just a way to talk about two-way volatility, because, you know, people can talk about the VIX and have different interpretations of it, but really the VIX only moves higher, at least, if there's downside volatility. As we know, market crash, VIX spikes. But, you know, the 2022 was treacherous for both sides just because those moves were so pronounced in both directions. So that was, regardless of what the VIX was doing, if you had two, you know, big moves on both sides, you're going to have a heightened two-way volatility, which this makes it very difficult to trust pattern breakouts. And so, you know, back in 2023, again, just using that as an example, this is right with us, there were, you know, 10 more 1% advances than the client. So again, pretty obvious, right? And we can just go back to just what happened since this past October. Looking at the market right now, there's only 1% decline since October 27th. That was on December 20th, and 9% advances. But 5 of those occur in the first 12 days, right? And we had the Zweig breath thrust and everything going berserk. But since then, that means that only 4 have happened in the last 2 months or and change, right? So that's the type of thing where, you know, if I can see this market continuing higher, it's going to have to be like that. It has to be slow, steady, and consistent. And we can go back and look in times when that has occurred in the past, right? 2021, 19, 17, 13, you know, come to mind. And we can go back and see instances of this as well. And so, and the last thing, again, is consistent closes above the midpoint. And so, you know, this is not going to be like this forever. But if you just go back again to the beginning of this run, 80% of the days have seen the S&P close above its midpoint. And so, you know, that's maybe looking at things a little bit in too granular basis, but at the same time, you know, pulling back to where I was on institutional, you know, trading desk, I know that, you know, one of the biggest algorithms and simplest algorithms that people use, or two of them really, are, you know, VWAP, or trying to beat the VWAP of the day, the average weighted price, right? Value average weighted price, and also just percentage of volume. So a lot of clients will use those when they just want to participate in a day on the way up. It's because they don't want to pick sides. They think the market's going higher. So they're willing to buy with the notion that they're going to continue to buy as days go on. All right? And that kind of creates the good closes on a consistent basis. And so all this is fine and good. But remember, like, the reverse was happening in 3 months before this. The reverse was happening to an extended amount in 2022. And in both times, you can get extreme overbought and extreme oversold that can last for a long time. So we kind of almost need to throw that out to an extent, because the first day that the S&P had, you know, overbought RSI reading was back on November 20th. Right. And so, as we know, now we're 2 months more into it. And so that's why we try to look at a number of different factors other than traditional overbought, oversold indicators to get an idea of when this can change.
Do you look at sector leadership throughout that? Because that, you know, I get the point, right? Above the midpoint makes sense because you're strengthening into the day, obviously. And that's, you know, in quotes, the smart money, however you want to define smart. That's a whole different, you know, discussion. But is there anything to that analysis thought being granular in terms of, you know, seeing that dynamic play out in more than one sector, cyclicals, defensives, or is it purely just on the S&P itself?
Well, yeah, S&P, but as we know, I'm sure, Michael, you're nailing this point home, is that it's led by the biggest names, right? Just the way it's calculated. And so that's important. But, you know, we could also take it on the other side is, you know, if we're just looking for bullish breakouts or whatever, something that's positive, right? We can look across any index and try to find the winners in that sense. You know, the relative strength winners, the ones that are working and the ones that are not working. From a sector perspective, of course, and you want to see the ones that have the biggest weights do the best if you're looking at the index itself. You know, recently, you know, the defensive sectors haven't been doing that well. And someone could say, well, that means that, you know, speculation is going after the ones that typically outperform, right? And so, you know, I agree with you. There is a clear division between the biggest ones and not, but there's also something to be said about, there's a number of names within, you know, the S&P that did just very well last year that weren't part of, say, the Magnificent Seven.
Yeah, and actually, I've been surprised myself at just how brutal the turnaround has been on the defensive sectors, in particular utilities. I mean, that makes me, though, think that from a contrarian perspective, you know, I've used that line before at major turning points, nobody's prepared, right? When you have, you know, kind of a capitulation, relative weakness in utility staples and healthcare, and while that should be seen as a bullish sign, the speed of it, I think, is a bit concerning.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, I would say this, you know, if I'm looking for, you know, some of the things I just talked about as turning, right, this strategy I'm talking about is never going to nail the top, right? Didn't nail the top at, you know, 2018 vol implosion. And you can say that after that point, right, things were going just fine. Like, you know, new highs, no indication of any breadth divergence by that point. But at the same time, back then, and again, I'm not saying that this is any means of calling the top, but there was an indication of things changing, only because you went from 2017, as we know, the least volatile uptrend ever, and things just got overheated in January. So it looked like things were changing just a bit. And so we can say maybe the same thing happening, you know, if you look at what, you know, technology has done recently, up 12 out of 13 days, overbought again, right? Up about, what, I don't know, 10 to 11% in the last 13 days. So there's I would say, you know, pockets of that happening. You have to be concerned about it. I guess the other part is this, is that when we talk about how strength begets strength, and that's been happening, right? And so, you know, for instance, it was looked at when the market was up again, now we're up 6 days in a row through yesterday, but through 5 days, going back to 2009, I was running a quick study for our clients 2 days ago, or yesterday, and 80% of the time, market was up 2 weeks later. And in the last 11 instances that it happened, the market was up 100%. So the last 11 instances were things that happened last year, 2023, and things that happened in 2021, right? So uptrending markets. The last one, of course, you know, 2022 didn't work out at all. And what the thing was about that, there weren't any five-day winning streaks there, right? So it's like, I understand the point of sometimes trying to identify when the top is coming, but we've seen in the past, the markets extend for coming out of volatile periods longer than we think.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Hello, listeners. Michael Guyatt here from Lead Lag Live. Are you ready to take a deep dive into market trends, risk management, and investment strategies? Then you need the Lead Lag Report. Our in-depth analysis helps you understand the financial markets like never before. And guess what? We're giving you a chance to experience it at a discounted rate. Visit theleadlag.report/leadlaglive and get an exclusive 30% off on your subscription. Don't miss out. Level up your investment game with the Lead Lag Report. And now, back to our discussion.
Think they can.
Do you look at all outside of U.S. equities, or are you primarily on the U.S. side?
Primarily on the U.S. side, but I keep track of the major ETFs and across the globe as well.
Yeah, I only mention that because I do think it will be interesting to see if, you know, if China were to really stimulate in a sudden aggressive way, what that might mean for U.S. equities and some co-movement potential there. Obviously, you know, China's stock markets have not correlated at all and haven't really affected us in terms of their weakness, but yeah, that may not be true on the other side of it if suddenly they reaccelerate.
No, exactly. That's a big one, because, you know, just running a screen every week of the ones that are outperforming, underperforming, that just continues to make lower lows. You know, not just there either. Like you can say, you know, Thailand, you can include them as well, South Korea, and obviously Japan not doing the opposite. And so I think you bring up a good point, though, Michael. At some point, everything that you're talking about and, you know, could matter, and it can matter quickly, just because we've seen how things reverse the way they do. So you can't get complacent with any of this. And I think anyone who says, you know, the worst is behind us and there's clear sailing ahead, you know, you can't ignore the fact that something can change right away. And, you know, that's why I'm trying to look for signs along the way, see if that's going to occur. So, you know, one of the things, of course, is talking about bullish patterns, right? There's also when there's an uptrend, you just don't have bearish patterns work out. Very obvious, very important at the same time. So for the S&P, there's been a few instances. You can point to any really consolidation pattern as potential reversal. Hasn't happened. But there are some other areas that, you know, are potentially showing a little bit different. For instance, you know, the ARK ETF that everyone talks about, right? It's been testing a potential topping pattern. So someone could just call it a, you know, again, a pause right now. But, you know, it hasn't closed above its 50-day moving average in a number of days, where, you know, XLK technology ETF is sitting 8% above its own 50-day over, you know, just right now. And so I want to say something had to give there, but it's interesting when you see, even within the tech sector, if you want to call it, or a growth, that there's divergences. So, you know, I would say that rather have big cap tech leading than ARK at this point. But at the same time, when they were both were going up at a good clip, and now one is not, just makes you pause at the very least.
Yeah, and a lot of those dynamics, you can argue, are also just similar with small cap in general. And for example, retailer ETF, XRT, I also emphasize that. It's just still in a big sideways pattern. I would think if it's a healthy secular bull, that you should see some of that participation from the areas which are most sensitive to the consumer, to the economy, and that's still kind of meandering. Am I crazy to think that this is one of the more... disconnect is not quite the right word, but that there's just a lot of divergences in terms of the headline averages and things inside the averages.
Yeah, and I guess the question is, do they have those divergences widen, or do the ones that haven't broken out yet catch up, for instance? Right? So I point to the industrials. Obviously, it has participated, and there's a number of them making new highs throughout the course of the last few weeks. But, you know, that XLI stopped going up in the middle of 2021, you know, before anything else did. And now it's trying to capitalize on what could be a three-year breakout, right? Not many people are talking about it, but that's a very important sector, right? It has 78 names in it, which is the most of any sector in the S&P 500. So if there's going to be a talk of breath in something, you know, continuing at if and when technology has the air taken out of it, it's going to have to be industrials, right? And that you would think, obviously, sensitive to the economy and has a lot of names in it, but also healthcare as well, same thing, where it hasn't broken out yet, it's been consolidating. So that means it's diverse. I mean, it's lagging in terms of breaking out, but does it mean it's set up to be the next one to get capital in? And can the market continue to hang in there if technology needs to pull back, you know, as we know it has to at some point, pull back more, right? That's going to be the key thing is, are people going to be freaked out when Apple or whatever, one of those drops 10% pretty quickly if everything else hasn't broken out yet? You know, that's going to be a big question.
Yeah, and actually even getting less play than industrials is small cap industrials, right? The XLIS, you know, has been the clear divergent winner among the small cap space. I mean, that's usually, from what I've seen, cap overwhelms sector. But in the case of industrials, you know, sector is overwhelmed cap.
And I think another one to look at, I'm talking about recently, just changing gears a little bit, is the QQQJ ETF, which is basically just the NASDAQ 100, or should say the NASDAQ names 100 to 200 in terms of market cap, right? And so that's obviously right below NDX, but looks much different, right? Now, there'd be some names that people recognize, but not a lot. And so that, of course, has been up as well. But if you look at the chart of that one, it looks much different than the NDX, which is making new highs and obviously breaking out along the way. This is just still trying to get through a multi-year base. And so maybe it looks like ARK, maybe it looks like something else. So again, the other question is, you know, if small caps are going to come back, you would see it in technology as well. And again, this is talking about NASDAQ in general, that has a lot of tiny names in it. These are still relatively big companies, right? Just not the biggest ones. And so again, they're just looking for signs of things. And so one sign of this continuing is possibly seeing an ETF like that and the names in it, you know, start to outperform again.
Okay, so you've got the research, you've got the sort of macro views and the calls on different markets. Are you doing specific recommendations on, you know, where to position within the averages? You know, let's get a little granular in terms of some of the things that you're starting to kind of push out there on the research.
Yeah, well, within that, it's always just identifying where there's opportunity. And so I look for a number of things. Number one, you know, just budding breakout candidates. We talked about some of them already, XLI, XLV, but, you know, they'll also go through a number of stocks, and those change by the day sometimes, right? Some people want just swing ideas, and other times just looking for errors that are in uptrends but have gotten oversold or close to oversold, and then looking for a bounce. And then just, we haven't had many of these, of course, now, but when you have extremely oversold, things that have just gotten really out of whack and due for a bounce. Again, that type of trade really hasn't been here. And the other side, of course, is on the bearish side. And so we talked about this a few weeks ago when the market was selling off to begin the year and was trying to identify, you know, bearish patterns. And the message was that the ones that have gotten hit the hardest are those the ones that got overextended the most. And so that's why I'm hesitant right now. Like, you know, if I look at the market, started to look at, you know, some obviously energy looks different. And there's some, if you go into it, there's a number of stocks still looks like they want to roll over in that sense. But there's not many, and you brought up utilities, same type of thing. But beyond that, there's not many classical bearish patterns, so to speak. But there's going to be opportunities where the really extended names, you know, have a potential pullback right now. And so I think I find it very difficult to identify those when you're making new highs. But I think it's going to be interesting if and when they pull back, and then you have potential lower high right in place for the semis or whatever else like that. And then we can talk about, you know, a quick snapback to fill some gaps.
But what would be the suggestion in that scenario? Would it be just to lighten up, or, you know, short, or just wait? I mean, you know, if you have a setup like that, how you take advantage of it is a big question.
Right. Well, you know, it depends. A lot of people obviously don't want to short or can't. So if they're long, then obviously see lighten up at that point. But I would say that, you know, the number of people can short, and I think that's fine as long as we have managed stop areas. And that's very important, right? Because with all of these, you can make the case that the odds are something's going to pull back, as we've seen, right? That hasn't played out for the last number of weeks. So we have to have a short leash on it. And I think probably what you've really seen happen, especially again, just looking at SMH as an example, where, you know, topped out pretty strongly at the end of December, looked like it was about to roll over more. Clearly it didn't. And so if you were to hold on, you know, stubbornly to think that, you know, we're still going to do for that pullback, well, now you're, you know, you're on the SMH one from 175 to 195, can't hold on. And so we're always keen to point out the fact that, you know, where are we wrong, right? Where is this possibly not going to work out? And I think especially on the short side, you have to be cognizant of that now.
Just to reset the room, everybody, please make sure you follow Frank Capillari here on X. If any of you want to come up and ask questions, click that bottom left MicroQuest button. And as always, this will be a podcast under Lead Lag Live on all of your favorite platforms. So you've dealt with a lot of the institutional side, obviously quite a bit in your career. Do you often find that when you're dealing with institutions, when you're dealing with different traders, people that are asking you for your thoughts on markets, that they're simply looking for confirmation of their own views, or are they more just trying to see if, you know, what you're saying has merit against how they're thinking? I mention that because I think there's always this challenge when you're putting content and research out there. People want, they seek out people that think like they do, right? I mean, that's just the reality. There's a confirmation bias that happens in this business. Any thoughts on that? Because I've heard from others that put research out there that when their own clients start pushing back on them because of a particular narrative, they tend to actually be more right than wrong, meaning the clients are wrong.
Right. Yeah. No, I know what you're saying. I'll say this. The best experiences I had randomly enough is with, say, a fundamental analyst that admittedly doesn't use technicals, but understands that it's important to know what's going on. And so I think that's the perfect combination between fundamentals and technicals, because you need both to understand. So if you're, you know, a successful portfolio manager that's relied on value investing or whatnot, you're probably also very good at identifying spots to lighten up and not. And so working with, you know, someone like me who just will identify that without having a, you know, too much of a bias either way, giving it to someone who is willing to accept independent thought, I think works really well. Whereas, you know, over the time when I was, you know, doing trading and commentary, I get a lot of people said, oh, I'll just visit XYZ fund. This guy loves technicals. Give him a call. I always know that's not going to go well because the person probably has one way of looking at something, or at least I've experienced, and doesn't want to hear anything more, unless, like you said, it's confirmation bias. So it goes, you know, individual by individual, fund by fund. But through the years, that's the type of person that I find it most, at least from institutional side, most helpful to work with.
And do you find that there's been, over time, increasingly more demand for, you know, thoughts on what's happening like right here, right now, as opposed to, you know, more of an intermediate, longer term view. I mean, I think in general, the entire industry has gotten short term, but, you know, I've got to imagine it's worse than it's ever been.
I think so. And I think we've seen it too, with just some of the bigger names, equity strategist calls, right? More of them are talking about technicals and talking about moving averages than I've ever thought I'd know. And it's been only because, or I say only, one of the reasons is because maybe the thesis that they originally had out there didn't play out yet. Right. And so it's an easy thing to go on. And, you know, it's funny, I working with some of the fundamental analysts before I left, I'd always be, you know, very respectful of, you know, talking to them about stock they covered, right? They're obviously in it and they taught the management and just obviously very consuming of what they do. And if I had a different opinion, I would say, you know, I'm looking to write this note, but you have a buy on XYZ, you know, I just want to make sure you're aware of it. Is it okay if I do that? And a lot of times one particular gentleman happened to be wrong on a certain stock. And he was like, please, you can put anything else you want out there as long as the intention's off me for a little bit. And so you have that as well, where they know that they're too close to it a little bit. And, you know, I feel for some of those guys as well, where sometimes you have a thesis, you have to wait for it to play out. Sometimes it takes a quarter or two. And in the meantime, you know, if a market event happens, you're talking about, you know, 20-25% swing sometimes only because it's moving with its industry or group.
But I will say that something that I think people under appreciate that you can be right or wrong depending upon where your endpoint is, right, on the calendar, right? And you reference that word yet, right? Which I think is interesting. You know, you can have a thesis and it's not playing out, and then people say, well, you're early and wrong is the same. I always have an issue with that line of thinking, because you can be early, wrong, and still manage risk, but if you're late and right, you can't do anything about it, right? So how do you know when to abandon a viewpoint or a thesis? Never mind sort of the technical aspect of it, from a research, you know, mindset. That's not easy, right? To know the point where you have to just totally flip your conclusions.
Yeah, I agree with you. It depends on what you're looking at and also what your time horizon is. So I think, you know, the inflation debate is a very interesting one for that reason alone, where looking at either the 10-year yield or inflation in general, you know, it can take a while, twists and turns, and it takes a long time to play out, right? So you can have people arguing really strongly on both sides, no one's going to give in. You're not going to know who was quote unquote right for 10 years potentially, right? And if you just look at the 10-year yield jumping around a little bit, you're talking about coming out of a 4-decade trend, and you have a bounce now, and you know, you can get very frustrated looking at this, and how I do sometimes, and I look at patterns, right? Looking at this pattern, but thinking that a breakout or a breakdown is going to occur in bonds doesn't work out as much sometimes. And just because it's a slower moving animal. And I remember I was at a conference, you know, a few years ago with the gentleman that ran a successful, you know, trend following platform. And at the time it was a choppy market. And someone said, what do you do with times like this? Well, he always says that there's something always in a long-term trend. And he's like, the asset that kept him in business almost his entire career were treasury bonds because of the way they moved and, you know, back and forth. But overall, that trend was, again, as we know, 40 years long. And so along the way, I'm sure he was wrong, right, by other people looking at something from a short term, meaning just 2 years at a time. I'm talking about 2 years inside of 40 years is much different. And we know, Michael, going back into like the 1960s, there's haven't been too many trends in yields, just about 3 or 4, and they've lasted for decades. So right now, you know, if I'm looking at just really big picture, 10-year yield, you know, I think it's generational lows are in, not too much of a shock to say that, near zero, with, you know, foreign markets below zero. I don't think we're going back to that anytime soon. So I don't see how or why, you know, the 10-year yield just can't be moving higher over the course of the next 2 decades or more. What that means for, you know, the Fed to cut rates over the next 2 or 3 months, who knows? But that's the backdrop. And I think eventually, you know, you're going to have a rotation in the market. Again, I'm talking about years now, but that's the type of thing that, you know, if I'm looking at that and think like that, I'm still going to point out when I think the 10-year yield is about to roll over now, because I think that could last, you know, if it does or anything like that, because there's this, it can play out for, who knows, 6 months to a year, but still maintain an uptrend.
That's interesting to say that. And, you know, look, I'm the first one to say nobody can predict the future. Who the hell knows how things will play out tomorrow, right? I mean, we're all trying to go based on conditions, probabilities. But let's play that out, because this is, maybe this is my own hang up, right? But I this is a classic example of why I think there's a narrative mismatch happening. So if you're going to have yields rise over the next two decades, that's counter to the disinflationary aspects of AI, which is a more than a two decade phenomenon if it's all it's supposedly touted out to be, right? Because AI is supposed to be efficiency enhancing, and anything that's technologically efficient shifts the yield curve to lower average rates, not higher average rates. Now, I get it. There's more than just obviously the efficiency and tech side that impacts rates, but I can't quite square that circle, sort of the idea of higher rates against AI taking over everything.
Yeah, I have no idea either for that. But I mean, I guess we're also in the early stages of that as well. And does that come, I don't know, but does that come commoditized somehow, or what kind of shifts does it take, and what kind of, what's the next iteration of AI 10 years from now? No idea, right? There's going to be industries developed. Again, I don't want to get, you know, too preachy or anything, but there's going to be things developed. We have no idea what's coming. But one thing we know is that human nature, in some regard, is still going to be there. And just looking back in the last 100 years, things have changed dramatically, but long trends tend to pop up regardless in a 10-year yield or the market.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Foodies unite with How You Dish. It's social media with a secret sauce. Food, the world's first network for food enthusiasts. How You Dish connects foodies across the world. Share kitchen tips and recipe hacks. Discover hidden gem food joints and street food. Find foodies like you. Connect, chat, and organize meetups. How You Dish makes it simple to connect through food anywhere in the world. So, how do you dish? Download How You Dish on the Apple App Store now.
Do you find it hard to, you know, to differentiate? I mean, you mentioned earlier, right? Like, there's tons of research services, tons of newsletter services, tons of people that have great ideas. And listen, I mean, we're all in the same space. I've got my own research, right, that I put out similar to you. It's not easy, right, to sort of get attention and kind of stand out. I'm curious kind of your own thoughts on, you know, aside from the relationships and the name building and the media stuff that you've done, you know, do you find that it's just hard to really kind of stand out unless you get like a major, major thing right? Because if that's the case, you know, there is an incentive, right, to maybe make for a big call on something. And then if it works out, then suddenly you're the guy.
Right. Well, I should probably be asking you that based on what you have going
on. No, listen, I'm the first one to say it. Like, I got known, you know, really from 2011 when I said there's a summer crash coming before the, you know, first week of August. I mean, that was the media breakout for me. And I think that's just part of the nature of the business. People do remember the home runs, not the strikeouts. I mean, that's just the way human psychology works. But yep. but that, you know, it has to be more than just a flash in the pan, right? And so it's just interesting to kind of think through from a business model perspective. How do you create a sustainable research service if you're not always hitting it out of the park?
Right. I think the key thing is, Michael's just consistency. And, you know, I've been, you know, doing this obviously for a long time. And along the way, you know, whether it's someone that I've, was that my same company or just a counterpart? And I got into that question a lot. And people have a lot of grand ideas. A lot of times those ideas are very good, but they can't do it on a consistent basis. And that's what really is a difference maker, because you can put out a few pieces here and there, and I've seen it many times where they get all good feedback. You just can't keep the pace up after that. And then it dies down. And then it's tough to come back from that, right? And so when I go through my content, I'm always trying to, you know, do small changes and improvements along the way. I'm very cognizant of that fact, is that whatever you do, you have to make sure that you do it well and on a routine basis, because people, you know, are robotic as well. And they know when, you know, well, they know when your podcasts are coming out. They know everything else that you do. You do it consistently, you do it very well, but you don't want to fall down on that. And if you do have to change things, you know, just tell them about it, and this is what I'm doing instead. And that's at least what I've done in the past and continue to do now, and to try to get into more things. Like, I recently started doing stuff on YouTube for the first time, but, you know, my plan was not to do that right away. You know, I had to understand how to run a business, understand where marketing was going, and that was part of the plan, you know, a year out or so. So I started doing that as an example. Other than that, I think big calls are important. Ironically, I'll go back to, you know, someone I used to work with at my old firm who always was on the other side of a big stock. It was a bear. I won't bring it up who, you know, what the name was, but always a bear. Stock always went up. Every other person on the street was a buy and was right. So you would think that person didn't do well. Well, that person was one of the biggest recipients of calls from the media to come on there because they just wanted to hear the other side, right? And so when you're different as well, obviously different and right is better than different and wrong. At the same time, I think what people want to hear is your view of it. If someone just says, oh, I don't like that stock and you're wrong, no one cares. But if you give them a quality explanation of why, that's very important as well. That's why I think, you know, again, I'll provide trade ideas, of course, like that, and but you know, explain why and the reasons that we're wrong as well, so people understand what's going on. Because I know that not everyone is going to want to, you know, to buy certain breakouts, whatever it is. But as long as they understand, you know, why it's out there, at the very least, it can lead them to understanding it and also maybe look for opportunities like that elsewhere and maybe in a universe they're more comfortable with.
I think that's a very well taken point about incentives too. To your point, it's like, you know, some people are bearish because they legitimately believe in the analysis. I mean, I'm in that camp because I believe that there's still credit been out there. I've been wrong on the timing, but if small caps, I don't think, are able to break out to new highs, small caps are probably agreeing with me that there's something off on the narrative still. The longer the divergence lasts, to the earlier point of the conversation, something gives at some point. But to your point, though, there are going to be plenty of people that are going to be bearish and loud and, you know, always the true, you know, doomsayers, because that's how they get media attention. And they don't really care about whether they're right or wrong. They just care about getting heard.
Yeah, that's unfortunate, too, especially now that we're on, you know, everyone on X, and it just gets enhanced in that sense. And so, you know, I'd bring another point up, too, is where, you know, there's so much noise out there. And sometimes it's very difficult to decipher who is, you know, talking about something logically and rationally. And just who's always on the side of the other side of things, just because they want to be that way. And it gets frustrating too, because there's some good content out there. And unless you take some time to really look at it, you're going to miss that part of it. And again, that's why, you know, one of the, you know, again, reasons why I wanted to start this on my own as an independent voice in that sense, just because, especially now on, you know, on X, where you can subscribe to someone's content for, I don't know how much it is, like a very cheap amount. And the goal is just to get as many people on there as possible, and who knows what else. But if it doesn't go beyond that, right, you're not running a real business with it, I think you have to be hesitant.
Which I think is also hard for people. It's a healthy dose of skepticism is not easily found among bulls or bears. And I don't know how you, I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. I mean, you can argue that that's what creates, you know, very powerful momentum trades when there is no skepticism, but it's also where the risk is highest.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, the most part, you know, you talk to some people and, you know, I remember it's a lot of questions I get sometimes is, you know, do you think this is worth doing? A trade, whatever it is. And I always say, if you have a predetermined area that you're going to manage risk at, then anything is at that point, you know, maybe not everything, but you know what I mean? If there's something that's liquid and you can put a stop on to tell you when you're wrong and you actually adhere to it, then that's important. So that can get into like talking about process and plan and all that. And I think it's very important as well, especially in a market like this, where, you know, if you talk about NVIDIA or any one of those, you can just get excited about something just because the price is moving up. It's just human nature sometimes, right? You know, as price action gets better, people get more excited about it for better or for worse. And so, you know, maybe someone who wants to put on a trade or buy into a stock like that is just hesitant because it's up so much and it has been no matter where you look at it. But then you could possibly miss the next leg as well. And if you're a trader, right, and you're just looking for the next opportunity and you can manage risk by putting a stop in, just, you know, whatever you want to put it on, a moving average, a percentage below a former support zone, then you should do it, right? At the very least, I think that it eliminates the ask of why. Yes, you can get stopped out and the thing will go up again. Happened to me many times. But at the same time, if you just avoid it just because you're scared of what could happen, not utilizing those risk management tools, I think it's a setback as well.
What do you find most people get wrong about technical analysis and the kind of work that you do? There is the line out there that technical analysis is astrology for men. I often poke fun at what I call the squiggle boys, right? And I'm not against technical analysis by any means. I put out two papers that won the Dow Award from the Chartered Market Technicians Association. I know those guys very well. And what I hesitate on is people referencing patterns without actually backtesting if there's real predictive power, right? And maybe that's where the confusion lies in. But what do you think people get most right and most wrong about
tech analysis?
Well, I guess it's just having a viewpoint from a topical sense, right? And the point too is there's so many different ways to use the different tools, right? Just going through the CMT process, if anyone who's taken them or at least level one, you get access to so many things. And most of them I don't use, right? They just don't make sense to me, or other things make more sense to me. And so I remember vividly for a while, I was getting some newsletters myself. And one of the guys has a very strong track record of you know, just regular chart pattern breakouts, right? And measure moves and very simple. That's kind of thing what I typically do as well. Where the other one was using DeMarc indicators. And I remember one time seeing these trade ideas, they're the same stock. One of them was recommending buying it, other one was recommending shorting it for, you know, reasons that they laid out. And because of how it played out, they both ended up making money over the next 3 weeks, just because of different ways of managing money and different, you know, strategies they use. So, and they're both, you know, probably poking fun at one another because they got it wrong. You know, so that type of thing where you can be right, not in your own way, and still look like it's wrong, if that makes sense.
Frank, for those who want to track more of your work, more research, where would you point them to? And maybe just do kind of a little pitch on your service.
Oh, sure. Thanks, Mike. So I would go to capthesis.com. It's CapThesis. And just looking at my page here on Excel, I'll be able to click on it. And there's just, we always have some free content newsletters on the front page there. And you subscribe to my free newsletter, Cap Notes, and also you can see the premium offerings there as well. I'm also active on LinkedIn. I would say too, you can check out the YouTube channel. Just go to Cap Thesis and YouTube. Try to put out one or two videos, you know, between say 5 and 10 minutes. Just give you a breakdown of what I'm seeing from the major indices and some shorts as well on there. And other than that, I would just say, you know, reach out on email anytime too. It's frankcap@capthesis.com. And if anyone wants any of the charts or things we talked about, happy to provide that with them as well.
Everybody, please give Frank a follow here. I've got, I think, like 6 spaces lined up next week. Going to be a busy week for content, but appreciate all those that joined here. Hopefully I will see you all then, and everybody enjoy the weekend. Thank you, Frank. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Michael.
Cheers, everybody.
The content in this program is for informational purposes only. You should not construe any information or other material as investment, financial, tax, or other advice. The views expressed by the participants are solely their own. A participant may have taken or recommended any investment position discussed, but may close such position or alter its recommendation at any time without notice. Nothing contained in this program constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, endorsement, or offer to buy or sell any securities or other financial instruments in any jurisdiction. Please consult your own investment or financial advisor for advice related to all investment decisions. Don't forget to follow at LeadLag Report on X, Instagram, Threads, and YouTube, and check out the LeadLag Report at www.leadlagreport.com. Use promo code PODCAST30 for 2 weeks free and 30% off to get access to award-winning research and anticipate stock market crashes, corrections, and bear markets.